Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with another episode in the ongoing series on and around autodestructive art. This week's guest is artist Michael Landy, who is a major player in what might ironically be called a genre now. Michael's autodestructive credentials include Scrap Heap Services from 1996, perhaps most notably Breakdown in 2001, when he and a team of workers pulped and shredded all of his possessions in a shop on Oxford Street. "It's like my own funeral, but I'm alive to watch it," he is quoted as saying. More recently, the art bin at the South London Gallery reduced artworks to landfill, and there is presently a large, tangly-like structure in the Louis Vuitton shop on Bond Street, which will destroy credit cards and produces tangly-like automatic drawings. Well, thank you very much for coming in, Michael. It's great that you could spare the time to be interviewed live on Wavelength.
Thank you.
So you
spent my whole career destroying things, but I'm a nice person. Believe me.
Okay, all right, I believe you. You look like a nice guy anyway.
I'm pretty nice. I blame it all on my mum, obviously. She didn't love me enough.
No?
Not enough hugs.
A story in itself.
Not enough hugs, but I did destroy all her Beatles collection when I was a child. So
you destroyed her Beatles collection?
Oh, yeah, right. When I was a child, so I think that's probably where it all started. Sister off a table.
Yeah. How did you destroy the Beatles collection? What did you do to
it? I don't know what technique I used for that, but I was probably too young to use a chainsaw or a bandsaw. It was probably much more improvised.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you were born in 1963. I hope you don't mind me mentioning that.
No.
You attended Loughborough Art School, as did
Duke.
I briefly,
yeah,
at some earlier point.
Yeah.
We've had that Loughborough conversation.
Yeah.
And you visited the large Jean Tanguy exhibition at Tate Britain in 1982?
Yeah, that's when I was still a textile student at Loughborough. Like, our once-a-term trip down to London coincided with an exhibition of Jean Tanguy's, his retrospective at the Tate Gallery. It wasn't called Tate Britain or Tate Modern that point. And I just absolutely loved it. His kinetic kind of machines that you could put your foot on, you know, the power stopper, and it would suddenly do some kind of jig or a pogo, and, you know, you could make your own metamatic drawings, you could ride the machines, you could throw balls into the machine. So it's very interactive, and it's the first time I'd really ever seen any people really interact with artworks, but also smile and laugh and enjoy them. And this, all this stuff's made out of junk, basically, welded together junk with motors and parts of it move. Sometimes he wasn't a very good engineer, so quite a lot of the time the things were broken, wouldn't work in the first place. So I just love the whole kind of energy surrounding it. And I think, like, Tanguy's work is much more... I mean, they're very human machines, and it's much more about life, I think, Gustav's works maybe much more nihilistic.
Well, I was going to say...
So I think they're kind of quite opposite kind of... the ethos behind it, I think, very, very different kind of feeling towards it. And I think he has if you look at lots of pictures of Tingley, I call him Tingley Tangley, you know, he's always got a cigarette and a hat in one hand and a glass of wine. He seemed to really enjoy his life, and he's like just passing through in a way. And that's what I really liked about him.
Yes, I remember going to that show. I always distinctly remember there was one particular, quite a small sculpture, which had... Did you press a button to get activate them or something?
Yeah, or a foot pedal, one or the other.
And it had like a piece of wire which went straight up in the air, and it had just a sort of feather on the end of it.
Yeah.
So there was this contraption which started whirring and clanking, and then all that would happen is this feather would tremble.
Yeah, they were completely ridiculous machines that didn't do anything as such. They kind of performed for you when they worked.
But as you say, the name of your... Well, there's a book... which accompanies the 2009 show at Liverpool.
Yeah,
actually called Joyous Machines, as it were.
Yeah.
And as you say, it's a very different aesthetic to, say, Gustav Metzger and John Latham, who were also into this sort of
Kind of early 1960s. I mean, I became... I mean, I that was my initial interest with Sean Tangley's work. And then after I did Breakdown, where I destroyed all my worldly belongings, which also included one of the drawings I got from his retrospective exhibition, one of his metamatic drawings, then I became interested in this piece called Homage to New York, which he made in 1960. Which basically is a self-constructing, self-destroying sculpture, which only existed for 27 minutes. And so I really like the similarities between Breakdown and Homage to New York. That, you know, Breakdown lasted for 2 weeks and it all went to a landfill site in Essex, and Homage to New York all ended up in back in a junkyard in New Jersey New York.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I like the idea of existence, that these things only exist for a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
They perform, you know, they do their thing. People witness it. People witness it in all sorts of different ways, and then it's gone, and you have no more responsibility towards it. And I think that's what Tangley liked about it as well, that it was like somehow taken away from a sculpture in a way, and making sculpture in a different way, where you're not so, where things aren't fixed in a sense.
But it's a sort of antithesis in a way, isn't it, of what most people are educated to. I mean, when you do art education, or when most people aspiring to be an artist, they imagine that their work is sort of going to outlive them or something, or they're leaving some lasting
legacy. Yeah, that kind of
legacy
thing. Yes, you leave a legacy, like you have people to look at pictures on the wall, or there's things to walk around, i.e. sculptures. And when he made Homage to York, he was quite a young man.
Hmm.
And I think at that point, he wasn't that bothered about having a legacy. I mean, he's, you know, the D.A. Pennybaker made a documentary filmmaker. He made a short film of Homage to New York, and there's some black and white pictures of it.
Yeah.
So I like the idea of recreating a sculpture that only lasted for 27 minutes. It was like made out of junk.
Yeah.
So, you know, it took him 3 weeks to make in the Buckminster Fuller Dome in the Museum of Modern Art Sculpture Garden. And then it was like 23 foot long by 27 foot high, and he just at the last minute he decided to paint everything white, and he was slightly perplexed because it snowed that morning before the performance, and he wanted the workmen to paint the snow black because he was worried that it would detract from his white sculpture. So yeah, but he was like, you know, it's and I just like the idea of making something that no longer exists, only for it to destroy itself once again, because that was what I was interested in. You know, recreating this artwork, but only for it to destroy itself once again. And the machine didn't actually destroy itself. New York Fire Brigade destroyed the machine.
What happened was he had
a bucket of petrol which poured onto a piano, which had a naked light, and it set the piano on fire. And the museum had a fire in the late 50s, and they were very, they were kind of, you know, they didn't want a fire. He basically didn't tell them about the fire.
Oh.
And then he had a fire extinguisher in the piano. Sorry, this all sounds a bit mad. And he was worried that the fire extinguisher would explode.
Oh, right.
And so it was actually Tangley that called in the New York Fire Brigade to destroy the work, not the New York authorities, not the museum.
Yeah, yeah.
Because everyone thought the museum had called in the firemen to destroy the artwork.
Yeah, yeah.
But so I think ultimately, in the end, the artwork wasn't capable of destroying itself. So it's actually the New York Fire Brigade that destroyed it in the end.
So was that your first encounter with autodestructive art? Had you?
I'd already done Breakdown, but I mean, I'd read about Gustav's work.
When you went to the Tate show and saw Tangley.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that was.
Because would you have travelled down from Loughborough? Was that
working with junk at that point, collecting junk and making it into irregular patterns. So, and obviously, most of Tangley's work comes from the scrap heap one way or another.
Right.
And so, so there was that kind of similarity, but that was the first time I'd ever come across Sean Tangley's work or Nouveau Realism or anything like that. And then years later, then I read about Gustav Metzger's work as well.
Right, right. And of course, there was apparently in the middle of it's Homage to New York is the name of the machine that he made.
Yeah.
Apparently Robert Rauschenberg had inserted some sort of little contraption in there which flung coins out.
Yeah, he made a mascot and basically it was it was on springs and had like silver dollar coins, and at a certain point in the performance then the spring
sort of
sprang out and the coins flew out into the audience. And at the end of the recording of there's some sound recordings of the sculpture, you hear people at the end, like they're like cannibals. They pull in bits of the sculpture away and get in Tangley to sign it for them.
Oh, right.
So I made a documentary where I tried to reconstruct the story via the people who've actually collected these these remnants. So I put an advert in Art Forum and places, try and find people who took these bits of scrap away with them back in the 60s.
Yeah.
And so I tried to construct a documentary through that. But I mean, ultimately, I mean, it was, you know, I mean, at the end of the documentary, I'm like, the copyright permission, I was turned down to recreate it. And which I'm giving up. I mean, I've said no to my face, said no to me in email, but I keep persevering because I think one day I will do it, but just not right now.
Yeah. So Joyous Machines, which is strangely a more life affirming kind of title, I suppose, because Gustav's attitude is, of course, fairly pessimistic. I mean, I was actually talking to him earlier, and he's talking about the sort of extinction of life as we know it and so on.
Well, I think that's probably not that jolly topic.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, that's partly how I tried to touch on in Breakdown, was the sense that, you know, if we all end up being consumers and all end up with 7,000 odd objects, what happens to the planet and what, you know, all those kind of issues about consumerism and about, I mean, at the time I talked about it as an examination of consumerism, and as a child, the way you examine things is by literally taking it apart. And so that's what I was interested in. And it came at a point in my life where I, for the first time in my art career, I just sold scrap heap services to the Tate. So I had some money, and then I thought about how I could screw it up for myself. I had a car, a Saab 900 car, suit. And I decided, well, how could I screw that up for myself?
Why would you want to do that?
I know, I don't know. It just popped into my head one day at the kitchen table.
Were you worried about becoming successful?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Right.
And I've always worried about that in a sense that, not successful, I'm quite good at when things are going badly. I'm not so good at when things are going well.
All right, that's interesting.
Yeah. So I don't know what to do with myself then.
Yeah.
But I'm much happier when things aren't going so well. I know where I am then.
Right.
As when you're a psychoanalyst.
Not yet, no.
No. So I thought about how I could basically just throw a spanner into the works, really, and make it uncomfortable for myself, in a sense, and that's
the extraordinary thing is the way that this... I actually said this to Gustav Metzger as well, the way that he's created a position for himself within art history.
Yeah.
By this sort of what could almost be seen as sort of, I don't know, not quite suicidal, but by actually breaking things up and destroying art and being anti-art. Mm. Whereas if his contemporaries were people like Auerbach and Kossoff, if he'd stuck with that being a painter, he'd probably be a sort of very minor figure.
Yeah.
But of course, he's by some odd flip of fate or whatever he wants to call it. Well, it's not, because he's pursued a rigorous, determined path. He's become, or emerging, as a very significant artist.
Yeah, completely. If you can still call it an artist radical, then Gustav is. I mean, it's quite interesting seeing his Serpentine show, because I was interested to see what, you know, being an autodestructive artist, in a sense, it's about nothingness, and how do you depict that? And because I wasn't quite sure what you have in an exhibition, you've got to have tangible things for people to look at or whatever. And so it's kind of.
But after Breakdown, I mean, you did this. You did Breakdown. You destroyed absolutely everything in your life
at the age of 37. Everything I possessed at that point, all
7,227. Stood up in.
That's the blue boiler suit from Art Angel, who commissioned the artwork. Yeah. But I literally had, literally nothing at the point when it took us like 2 weeks to dismantle and granulate and shred all my worldly belongings. And I made a whole inventory of everything I possessed. So we'd been making the list for about a year beforehand, and and then we heard that CNAs were moving out of Great Britain. Hmm. My project manager did, and we contacted CNAs, and you know, on Oxford Street, and it was like the mecca of shopping in London, and it was just a great venue to put on put on this exhibition, and you know, it just happened just after Christmas, and so you had people coming in, old ladies coming in, trying to return the goods they'd bought at CNA's at Christmas, and we had to tell them that it had gone, but it used to them,
right.
And so yeah, so people were just, it was just a, it's not an art gallery, it's not a museum, it's, you know, it was like the end of Ceausescu or something. They were still taking off the CNA signs the day before the exhibition started. And it was just a fantastic... I mean, the venue made it, basically.
Right.
So, you know, you had people buying DVDs, their latest DVDs, players or whatever, in Dixon's just down the road, and then coming in to see Breakdown. And what the hell was going on, really?
Right.
And then
yes.
as they got closer to it, then they realised, you know, it's like 100 metres of conveyor belt, and... And there were, like, objects that you could see was, like, a cuddly teddy bear or a DVD. And then there were objects that were, like my record player or whatever was, like, taken apart. And so you could see inside it as well.
Right.
So obviously most of the time we don't see how things work or, you know, the articulation of things in a sense. So I was interested in the guts of things. And you can kind of aestheticize that. And my Saab 900 car... I had all my clothes, books, old love letters, family pictures. So it was different values. Basically, it wasn't just, you know, your TV set. You know, there were all my artworks as well, the artworks my friends have. So it's literally, like, and it's just, you know, a made-up rule, but I just decided to destroy everything at that juncture. So,
yeah,
it was like witnessing my own funeral in some respects. Like people turning that I hadn't seen for years. priests coming, you know, and nuns and people from the clergy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, looking at, you know.
Who were they?
I don't know. They were just passing by. Passing by. All heard about it. All going to give a sermon about it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I witnessed it, and it was a fantastically liberating thing to do at the time, whilst it was going on. And for quite a long time afterwards, but it was very hard for me to move on as an artist afterwards because it was such a full stop, in a sense, to my creative. Like, how do you make art after that? Mm. How can you? Because it was
that is a sort of problem in a way, isn't it? It's about
you set yourself problems.
The problem is it can become almost like a theatrical gesture in a way because there is then. Because I remember you started to do etchings after that, didn't you?
Yeah.
Which is almost like, I mean, apparently Gustav even, I think he still does paintings. And
does he?
He reveres Vermeer.
Right.
He's got this big project about sort of, he thinks Vermeer is fantastic, you know.
Okay.
And,
he's kept that one quiet.
Yes. I think in one of these catalogues there's sort of very tashist sort of kind of brushstroke type.
Well, I think he began as a painter. Wasn't he taught by Bomberg?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so what happens? Because there is, in the catalogue Voids, what they were talking to Mathieu Copeland about, there is the case of an American artist, I think she's called Laurie Parsons, I can never quite remember the name, and she completely turned her back on the art world entirely. She sort of, you know, she was in the Voids exhibition, and she decided to basically eradicate herself. She's literally moved out of art altogether, and she tried to erase any trace of her last exhibition.
All right, how interesting.
And has, in theory, she's gone out of art. She no longer calls herself an artist.
Yeah.
But it remains to be seen whether or not she has the compulsion to actually start doing something again.
No, that's interesting, but someone said to me years later about Breakdown, they said, yeah, that's all well and good, but the only thing you didn't destroy was your name,
right.
Which was a really clever thing. So I hadn't even crossed my mind about that. But, yeah, I mean, because obviously from that I became better known and everything, you know. I mean, if you want to say it in a cynical way, then you can, you know, I became better known, which meant that, yeah, I became a better known artist and that, and all the things that go with that, in a sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And but that's not the reason I did it in the first place.
No. Okay. But then that led to the Art Bin in South London.
Yep, in a roundabout way, I guess, because I touched on the destruction of art in Breakdown, and then and in the art world, people really got hot under the collar about that. And I hadn't even realised that in this country, you, as a legal owner of an artwork, you can destroy it. You can't change its colour. You can't put Mickey Mouse ears on it. But you can, you can't show it in a deflammatory way, but you can destroy it. As in France, artists have much more moral rights than they do in this country. And and obviously as a producer of artworks, I was sort of intrigued by the whole thing about, because I was determined for the project not to get breakdown, that is, not to get hijacked by just the destruction of art. But then, yeah, years later at the South London Art Gallery, I made a great big bin, and I invited artists and collectors to throw the artworks into the bin. I called it kind of a monument to creative failure. So I asked people, mostly it was artists who took part, but to throw their works away.
Right, yeah. Right.
Ones that didn't work for whatever formal reasons, or the idea didn't work, or whatever. But then I quite like the idea of people throwing away perfectly good artworks as well.
Right.
So some people saw it as a sacrifice.
Yeah.
And other people saw it as just like cleaning out their studio. So it's lots of different. I mean, and then, you know, it was like a container that took up the whole of the South London Art Gallery. So it's made out of polycarbonate, so you could see into it. And then it was like six meters long by about 11 meters wide, and then there was a gantry where you could walk up and throw the work in.
Right,
so the most
right.
favourite questions people asked was, how do you get it to the other side, and what are you going to do with it afterwards? That was basically their favourite question. But I mean, it was on for 6 weeks, and I was there every day.
Yeah.
And so so you know, I talked to people about why they were throwing things away, or, you know, what motivated them to throw them. Works away. So it's very much more, it's very different to breakdown in that respect.
Right.
But, you know, it was like a ruin, basically. Like, people would throw the works in and then maybe it would explode on impact. And then, you know, the works became one whole work in a sense, because bits would shatter off onto another work or pierce the canvas. And that's the way, you know, so it was there. Mm. Yeah.
And at the moment, you've got something in this new Louis Vuitton shop, which is
I've got a nice suit out of it.
Did you?
Yeah.
Good.
I look good in it. You don't believe me?
No, I can believe it. But
I may have been born in 1963, but I can still.
Absolutely. The Louis Vuitton shop is basically a sort of, it's like a palace to consumerism in a way, isn't it? I mean, it's a very grand shop, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it's they don't. I mean, don't call it a shop. That's your first mistake.
Right. What do they call it?
I can't remember, but it's not. It's so. Yeah, I built basically. I came up with all sorts of ideas about what. Because obviously, something. You know, you could call me selling out, which could be the case. But it, you know, I'm partly an anti-consumerist artist, so I kind of half intrigued about why somebody would ask me to do something like that in the first place.
Well, I think it's very, very clever to take it to the heart of consumerism, because you're taking the idea. I mean, I think it's an amazing sort of achievement, in fact, to have got this idea into. I couldn't imagine whose idea. Did they invite you, or did you say, I'd like to? They must have commissioned you, presumably.
They basically commissioned me to. It's a bit more complicated, but they commissioned me to make it. And I came up with some ideas. First of all, I wanted to show some putrid rubbish in the windows, but obviously they said no to that.
Right.
And then I wanted to have an amnesty, like, so fake Louis Vuitton bags, and like we'd shred them in the windows, so it'd be like a knife amnesty, but for fake Louis Vuitton bags, so people could bring them into the store we could actually shred them in the windows.
Right.
But bizarrely, they said no to that as well.
But what you've made is a tangly like.
Yeah, it's inspired kinetic sculpture. This one works.
Which destroys
most of the
credit
time.
Cards.
Yeah, it destroys credit cards. And it also makes you a metamatic drawing. So it's the only free thing you can get in the shop.
Right.
And so it makes abstract drawings. But actually, sadly, it's no longer there.
Oh, isn't it?
Yeah, it was only there for the beginning of the shop. It was only supposed to be there for 3 days, but because it proved so popular that they kept it. But it got taken down, I think, last week.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
Yeah.
Okay. Did people actually put their credit cards into it?
Yeah, they did, yeah. People put their credit cards into it, and I think one credit card almost destroyed my credit card destroying machine. Somehow it got caught, and so it's... So, it was kinetic sculpture, but it also made drawings for you.
Right.
And,
Okay. Well, What about your... I wanted to ask you about the first show, the closing down sale.
Yes, we're mad. No, we're not joking. Lady came up to me a moment ago. She said to me, young man, how can you sell it so cheaply? I said, it's very simple, you see. I said, it's a massive sale. It's a monster sale. It's a £100,000 clearance sale. It will not be repeated. It will never be seen again. Step inside, do yourselves a favour, and everyone get a bargain here today. Bargains, bargains, bargains. They will not be repeated, and it will never be seen again.
Right. So that was the...
That was the audio for Closing Down Sale that I made in 1992.
That was 1992?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was at the height of the recession at that time.
The last...
At the Carsten Schubert
Gallery.
Last
one we had, yeah.
And your installation at what is now Tate Britain, semi-detached, which was your parents' house.
Yeah, my old parents... Well, my old parents are still alive. But yeah, in Essex, yeah. And it was basically just based around my dad had an industrial accident back in the 70s. So it was basically trying to deal with that and how it's like recreating. I basically recreated their house in Tate Britain.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Their pebble-dashed house in Essex and. And it's semi-detached because it was a semi-detached house.
Yeah.
And so just looking at, you know, what... Because my father, after his industrial... He was a tunnel miner. My parents are Irish. And he had an industrial accident and was never able to work again. And then, like, how the house becomes him in a way. And as he slowly starts to deteriorate the house, he's losing... The only jobs that he's left to do is basic jobs around the house. And as he even loses interest in that,
right.
Then the house starts to deteriorate and it becomes like his body, in a sense. And so it wasn't a lot of laughs making it, but it was kind of something I always, when I ever I went to visit my parents, I always left with a sense of not being able to, having a real sense of anger about my dad's predicament and not being able to articulate that.
Right.
And it always left me with a sense of, not being able to, and obviously I make art, and that's how I deal with the world. I make sense of the world through making art about it, and
And that, I was amazed to hear that that whole installation, which is basically a house, a whole house, even that ended up in landfill.
Yeah, I call it Landyfill. So so most of the career is still in landfill. We'll dig it up one day,
okay,
and have a retrospective.
Right. Well, that's about it. Thank you very much to Michael Landy for coming in and giving me his version of autodestructive art. And we'll play out now with a Jean Tangley sculpture recording from somewhere or other.